Hello and a very warm welcome to Central Stage. Good to have you with us. Now, last week was most certainly a crucial week for the Middle East. President Obama's first trip to Israel as president, of course, this forthcoming spring, beginning of yet another national dialogue in Bahrain 18 months after the first series came to nothing. And of course, Tunisia's plunging into political chaos after leftist opposition leader was murdered are some of the most extremely important and somewhat unexpected developments which made the past week stand out. Welcome back. Now, to further explore the crucial developments of the past week in the Middle East, two top guests join us today. Now, here in the studio, I'm very pleased to be joined by a highly accomplished scholar and researcher, Dr. Mahmoud Karimi. It's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Let me just tell you that Dr. Mahmoud Karimi has got real expertise in Islamic law. He's an established analyst and expert on political affairs of the world of Islam and the region. Dr. Karimi is also head of the Office for Academic and International Relations at Imam Sadegh University. Now, over the phone from Tehran, I'm delighted to be joined by an established and professional journalist, Mr. Guljamal Hossain. Welcome to Central Stage.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Pleasure to have you with us. Now, Mr. Guljamal Hossain is an established journalist and top writer working with Tehran Times, and he's also a political analyst, particularly when it comes to the world of Islam and the Middle East. Time for a short break, but after the break, we will be discussing the most important developments of the last week in the Middle East. So please do stay with Central Stage.
Last week was quite a crucial week for the Middle East with lots of significant developments. The announcement of President Obama's unexpected visit to Israel was most certainly one of such important developments. According to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, US President's visit to Israel will focus on Iran's nuclear energy program, the Syrian crisis, and Israel's talks with the Palestinian Authority. Netanyahu went on to describe Obama's trip to Israel as a very important visit. The White House, however, has deliberately sought to keep a low profile about the outcomes of Obama's visit to Israel. White House spokesman Jay Carney said the U.S. president had no plans to offer any proposals aimed at ending the two-year stalemate in the talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. Observers, however, contend that the visit will fall short of laying the groundwork for a meeting between acting Palestinian Authority Chief Mahmoud Abbas and Netanyahu. Even some Israeli analysts and officials view U.S. efforts to facilitate resumption of talks between Israel and Palestine as a tool to allay international fury over Israel's aggressive policies. Palestinians, on the other hand, warn that if Obama's visit or a resumption of negotiations derails Palestine's recent campaign to use its new UN status to gain support for international sanctions against Israel, the repercussions will be catastrophic for Palestinians. Another important development of the week almost coincided with February 14th, which is the second anniversary of the uprising in Bahrain. Since last week, Bahrainis have been staging demonstrations against the ruling Al-Khalifa regime. Despite the crackdown by security forces, it's important to note that such demonstrations were held ahead of national talks that started on February the 10th. Al-Wefaq National Islamic Society, which is the major opposition bloc in Bahrain and is attending the dialogue, has called for the establishment of a transitional government which represents different national factions as a first step to resolve the crisis in the country. The group also called on the regime to put an end to the ongoing crackdowns on media campaigns against dissidents. Despite expressing readiness to attend the talks, the opposition groups have cast doubt over the effectiveness of the talks. 6 members from the opposition and 8 from pro-regime groups will attend the talks, but it remains to be seen whether the new series of national dialogue will be any different from the old series of dialogue held 18 months ago.
Hello again, it's great to have you back with us. Now we're talking about the most important developments of the last week in the Middle East. To be honest with you, we wanted to focus on one topic, but we saw that there were lots of crucial topics that we just saw that we had to cover all of them. Now, first, let's talk about the announcement that President Barack Obama will visit Israel next month for the first time in his presidency. Now, according to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Obama's visit to Israel will focus, among other things, on Israel's talks with the Palestinian Authority. Now, Dr. Karimi, the point, you know, a number of analysts are saying that if this visit is meant to derail the efforts of the Palestinians to probably take Israel's case to the International Court of Justice and probably to actually put, try to, sorry, to basically offer some sanctions or try to attract some sort of approval from the other countries so that they could basically offer some sanctions against Israel, that would be the result actually would be catastrophic for Palestine.
Yes, since this is the first visit of Barack Obama to the Zionist regime, so it means that, you know, one of the motives is that Barack Obama has been under sharp criticism by the Zionist lobby why he has not visited Israel since his presidency and since he took presidential office, in fact.
And it's strange, isn't it?
Probably one of the few. Yes, it seems to be strange, especially when we see that Barack Obama visited Egypt, for example, in the neighboring Israel in the first presidency. But now, in the second round, he has tried to somehow attract the attention of the Zionists this way. And the foreign ministry of the Zionist regime has declared that there would be a visit, it's probable that there would be a visit between Barack Obama, the Zionist prime minister, and also Mahmoud Abbas.
Right.
But this is not confirmed by Palestinian authorities. So because they have said that there are some conditions, or we can say there are some preconditions for this kind of visit or negotiation.
Right.
For example, the first is that the Zionist regime should recognize the independent country of Palestine. And in fact, so this recognition would be important for them.
You mean the new state is the upgrade of the UN?
Yes, the new state. And the second is stopping the construction of Jewish settlements. And the third is, in fact, withdrawal of the Zionist army to the 1967 borders. And so if these happen, then it's probable that they would have a visit. But anyhow, we know that this visit, more than anything, would please the Zionist lobby. And it is less probable to serve the Palestinian, you know, the Palestinian interest. And also, it seems, or it is predicted, that there would be negotiations between the two parties about Iran and Syria. So it is not just an Israel and Palestine issue, but it would be more than that. It means the issues and the causes of
Iran and Syria
that also would serve the interest of the Zionist regime.
Right, but we know that the relationship between Obama and Netanyahu has not been a very good one. I mean, everybody's saying that probably they didn't have that sort of quite friendly relationship. So the question is, why now? I mean, 4 years, no visit. As you said, Obama even went to Egypt, but he didn't visit neighboring Israel. But now, after he's been re-elected, probably so there is no worries about his re-election. Probably he could have done it before, elections. But now he's doing it probably a few months after his re-election.
I think that The issue of Islamic awakening, or as they say it, the Arab Spring, also here is concerned, especially when see the Egypt, you know, as an Islamic country and somehow Islamic rule, also Tunisia and other countries. I think now the problems for the Zionist regime are more serious than before. And since the interests of the United States are somehow linked with the interests of the Zionist regime, so it means that this visit would be of great importance for them.
Right. So do you think that probably the Israeli lobby is pushing about President Obama to make such a visit?
Actually, right. I think definitely there is a push for that. And at the same time, it is also somehow, you know, that he would visit also some other countries like Jordan and Saudi Arabia. So it seems that all these countries, as Muslim countries, also are important for decision making in the United States and the Zionist region.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Karimi, for that. Now let's talk about another issue which took center stage last week. Mr. Golzamos Hossein, we know that Sunday was the beginning of yet another national dialogue in which Al-Khalifa regime invited political opponents to negotiate a solution to the country's long-running crisis in the Persian Gulf Kingdom. We know that there was another series of negotiations in July 2011. And at that time, we know that the government organized a similar round of dialogue. Most opposition groups decided to boycott the talks. Now, the party, we know that actually Al-Wefaq party withdrew after just 2 weeks at that time, and they said that the dialogue was not a serious effort. So are there any guarantees that the new series of national dialogue will be any different?
Yeah, okay, thank you. If you allow me, I can come to this a little later. First, I would like to comment on U.S. President Obama's visit to the Middle East, especially to Israel. I think there is one point that there is a crisis in a relationship between United States and Israel right now.
Right.
Especially there is a kind of a personality clash between Netanyahu and Obama. And Obama many times snubbed Netanyahu. Netanyahu visited United States. He didn't even meet a couple of times. He didn't even meet him there. So it's interesting that in his 4 years, U.S. president never visited Israel. Why this time? There is a point to it that Obama, this time in second term, he is more serious president. He wants to initiate a kind of dialogue between Palestinians and Israelis.
Right.
And want to get some kind of results. He knows that chances of success are very fewer, but he wants to start some kind of dialogue process between them so that... as you know, he is a president with a sense of history, so he wants to leave some kind of legacy,
right.
Or at least a positive influence. So I think, as far as Obama is concerned, it looks a serious visit. It's not to serve Israel only; it's to serve a purpose of peace. And the question is, will he succeed? I think chances are very few. Why? Because Netanyahu and the whole Israeli government is against any kind of peace initiatives from Obama administration.
Right.
So chances are less of success, but he is serious and he would make an effort. Now about Bahrain.
Okay.
Yeah, I think as you pointed out, Al-Wefaq doesn't consider this a serious offer for dialogue. Opposition in Bahrain knows that these are tactics only to waste time and to, you know, somehow pass time so that Bahraini government can bring next mayors or something. I think it's only playing with time, so that's why there is also a kind of reluctance on the part of Al-Wefaq that either they should join this effort or not.
Right. You actually mentioned Al-Wefaq, Mr. Golzamos Hossein, but we know that there are some other opposition groups. The leaders of some of them are actually in prison at the moment.
Yeah.
So probably they're not attending. So what's your take on that? I mean, do you think that the sort of national dialogue without the presence of the leaders of some of the opposition who are actually serving their prison terms at the moment, and some of the dissidents, like, for example, Dr. Saeed Chahabi, who's at the moment in London, I mean, they are also not attending. So how credible would that sort of national dialogue be without the presence of those key players in the opposition?
First thing, of course, it would not be that credible when the serious opposition leaders are not participating in this process. So rather, it's not credible at all. See, the Bahraini Al-Khalifa regime is not serious to have dialogue with opposition groups. If it was serious, why it launched a crackdown? And not only the regime launched a crackdown on pro-democracy or pro-revolution protesters, it also invited Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and other countries' forces to help them in crackdown. So currently, and there is another point of view, that actually the things in Bahrain are not in the hands of Bahraini government. Mm. Saudi Arabians are running the affairs. They are calling the shots in Bahrain, and they are managing all these things. So when another, it's a kind of a de facto Saudi rule in Bahrain, so how you can expect any kind of dialogue in which opposition can get some concessions and there can be some kind of, democratic process or some kind of dialogue. It's against the nature of Saudi regime, okay. So I think it's not possible. Nothing would come out, nothing positive would come out from this process.
Thanks very much indeed, Mr. Golgamas Hossain. Now, time for a short break, but after the break, we'll be talking about the timing of the so-called national dialogue in Bahrain, the second round after 18 months. So please do stay with Central Stage. Hello again, it's great to have you back with us. We're talking about the new series of National Dialogue in Bahrain, which has started on Sunday. And Dr. Karabi, I think that they've actually announced that they're going to have two meetings a week, starting, of course, last Sunday. And I think the second one is today, I think Sundays and Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken. The point is that I've just actually have some names of those leaders who are not attending. For example, Hassan Mushaima, he's suffering from long-term illness and he goes untreated. We have another one who is Abdul Jalil Singas, who's just begun a hunger strike along with other inmates. We have other staunch political opponents such as Saeed Chahabi, as I said, who's been forced to live in exile. What's your take on the point that a number of analysts are making, that probably these sort of dialogues in the absence of such important opposition leaders are not quite meaningful?
Yes, it seems that this kind of dialogue is just a matter of formality. You know, if we want a dialogue to be meaningful and to be somehow successful, it happens if the other party has a power or authority to change, to make a change or to make a new development. But if a regime is a puppet of other people or other governments, like the puppet of Saudi Arabia or the West, then it means that they themselves cannot make any change without the permission and without the authority of others. Right. Therefore, this kind of dialogue cannot be useful.
Al-Wefaq, actually, which is a very important opposition bloc, is attending. Probably they have some hopes, otherwise they wouldn't have attended the dialogue.
So in diplomacy, they would also mind anything which is probable. Right. Even, the least probable things may be concerned. But anyhow, when people are demonstrating against this kind of dialogues and they believe that this would not lead to anything, tangible and anything fruitful, and they say they believe that this is just this dialogue is just an instrument or a tactic to that the regime wants to hide the bitter realities of dictatorship in the country. They say, okay, we are ready to have dialogues. And in fact, this would be a matter of formality for that and going out of this bitter crisis. You know, it means that if they are serious, if this dialogue is serious, so firstly, they should say, okay, we are ready to release or free some of the political prisoners, or the government should be ready to make change in the constitution or to have the draft of the new constitution, or to be a referendum there for the new constitution. But they are not talking about these things.
But they're talking about the fact that probably a new prime minister. I think the Barony prime minister is the longest serving prime minister in the world. I don't know how many, probably tens of years. I think Al-Wefaq has agreed that the monarchy could stay there, but probably some changes, some democratic
some
changes.
Some constitutional changes.
Right.
Yes.
So that's what Al-Wefaq has already agreed. So they don't want the monarchy to go away. So that's a concession on the part of the opposition, isn't it?
Yes. Al-Wefaq has this position that, okay, if there are some serious constitutional reforms, then they can agree about the changes in the future government. But there are also some of political parties which are not satisfied for that, and they say and they are asking for the downfall of the government and of the monarchy. They believe that if we want real democracy, democracy does not go along with monarchy, because anyhow, if the monarch is the powerful and is the number one authority in the country, so what is the and where is the voice of people? Therefore, they are, and some of those who at first demanded for constitutional monarchy, now they are changing their position because they faced the, you know, the crackdown of the government. And therefore, they are changing their mind. I think that little by little, this position somehow would be weakened. And most of the people, or majority of people, since they feel that they are the majority ruled by the minority, and this should be vice versa, therefore they are not ready and they are not satisfied to accept that.
Great. Thanks very much indeed.
And in fact, yes, about the timing, why this time is important for them, or they have declared the dialogue at this time. Firstly, you know, they are also worried about new demonstrations in the anniversary, in the second anniversary of...
Which is today in Iran and probably some other places.
So tomorrow. This is one of their concerns. The second thing is that some of the human rights organizations and institutions have had positions against the monarchy. So they are also afraid of some, anyhow, human rights campaign and human rights positions against them. And also the third thing is that they feel... So as they have seen, or the Bahraini government has seen the victory of Tunisian government and the victory of Egyptian government, and they say, okay, it's probable that the same thing would happen to us. So they are somehow welcoming a kind of dialogue in order to buy the time and establish themselves.
Great. Mr. Golcan Hossain, Dr. Karimi there was talking about the timing of the new series of national dialogue, and we know that today is actually the second anniversary of the popular uprising in Bahrain. So do you think that probably the new series of dialogues are meant to stop people, or convince or persuade Bahraini opposition that, okay, look, you're doing something, please stop asking your followers to demonstrate and wait until something new happens?
Yeah, it looks a kind of tactics to divide actually opposition, that okay, regime is half serious maybe to have some kind of dialogue with opposition, members of opposition. So maybe some opposition protesters would arrange demonstrations, other would not. So it looks a tactic because it's now 2 years. 2 years have passed, and the Bahraini regime could not clamp down properly on revolutionaries in Bahrain. Still, the things are going on. Still, anti-regime protests are there. Still, the movement is very much alive. So, in order to create, I think, divisions more than other things. They have launched this process. If timing is concerned.
And another thing is, Mr. Goljam also said,
yes.
18 months ago, they started the same thing.
Yeah.
And now again, they're doing the same thing. And probably there should be some changes probably in the procedure or in the way they're doing things to make it, you know, a success this time round, if they really are looking for success.
No, they're not looking for success. Actually, Dr. Karimi is right. It's a kind of a pressure from human rights groups, some human rights groups, and Bahrain's some Western partners as well, who wants Bahrain to show a kind of a facade, that it's not dialogue, it's a facade for dialogue, that actually Bahraini government is doing something. So this doing something is going on. Nothing serious, nothing tangible would come out from this. Only this, that, okay, government is doing something to solace opposition protesters. And activists.
Excellent. Thank you very much indeed for those comments. Now let's take a short break. After the break, we'll be talking about another important development of the last week, to be precise, about Tunisia. So as I said earlier, we had lots of developments. Tunisia was most certainly one of them. So please just stay with us for that and more. Hello again, great to have you back with us. Now, Tunisia plunged into a political chaos after leftist opposition leader Shoukry Belaid was fatally shot, or murdered outside his home in the capital Tunis on February the 6th. Now, his assassination triggered violent demonstrations across the North African country, with the headquarters of the ruling Ennahda party being attacked in more than a dozen cities. Now, opposition groups have accused of being behind the assassination. However, we know that the party's leader, Rashid Al-Ghannouchi, condemned the act and rejected the allegations. And we had the Prime Minister first saying that we want to have a new cabinet, and later on they said that it was not coordinated. But first, Dr. Karimi, who do you think is to blame for that assassination? Because the government is now being accused of being behind it.
Mm-hmm. You know that this is the first political assassination after the victory of revolution in Tunisia. Mm-hmm. And it's important why at this time it happens. You know that Tunisia was somehow going toward stability. And this is something that two groups are not welcoming that. Mm-hmm. And they are not satisfied with that. Firstly, the minority who are not Islamist and who are just supporting some kind of secularism and
right.
The liberal government there, and they in fact they failed in the election, in the political elections, and so they were not satisfied for that. Then they want to create a new atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, the West, and especially the Americans, because they are not also satisfied with the ruling of the Islamist group in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in Tunisia, therefore they try to deviate the Islamic trend. Then it seems that, okay, it is probable that, yes, as you said, Rashid Al-Ghannouchi has condemned this assassination, and at the same time said that this can be, in fact, this can be done by those who are against democracy and those who failed in the election. So there can be two probable things. So, in fact, as to the problem, who is to blame?
Right.
First, we can say that it may refer to those extremists. In fact, the Islamist extremists.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to be less probable. And the second point is that foreign hands also here are involved, and the interference of foreign hands, especially, you know, because they want to deviate the right trend of the. You know, the Islamic trend of the revolution.
Right. So how serious is that situation? Do you think that it may get out of control like it did in Egypt?
So it is, you know, some analysts say that this is the first assassination, and there may be a series of assassinations later. And if this happens, and as you said, in a dozen of cities in Tunisia now, right. there are demonstrations and people are demonstrating against the government because, you know, they are not aware of what is behind that assassination. So if they know it, if they know the reality, maybe those demonstrations also would be somehow weakened. But yes, these foreign hands also, especially the France, because, you know, in Tunisia, we can say that more than 50 years, people were under the control of and under the pressure of those dictators who were led by France. And now France and the West have lost that position. Therefore, they want anyhow to restore that situation and that position. So it seems that, yes, this is the first step. And I think that Rashid al-Ghannouchi and other authorities in Ennahda party are clever enough, because he has accepted a kind of, you know, the national unity government and said right. that any government that is accepted and elected by people and is supported by the people, we would welcome it, no problem.
Great.
And yes, it would be good. But if they do not allow the voice of people and somehow the elections are not concerned, that then there would be a danger of something like what is happening in Egypt.
Okay, thank you very much for those words of wisdom. Now, we know that following the explosion of public anger over the murder that we just talked about, Tunisian Prime Minister Hamadi Jebali said in a televised address on Wednesday last week that he would dissolve the cabinet and form a new government of technocrats. However, Ennahda's parliamentary leader said on February the 7th that the premier's decision was rejected by his bloc of lawmakers. And the head of the government took, he said, the decision without consulting the ruling coalition or the Ennahda movement. Mr. Golja must say this really shows a lack of coordination, if not anything else.
Yes, it is lack of coordination indeed. But I want to come to that point that who was behind this Shukri Belat's murder and why at this time. Yes, there is a kind of feeling, it's a fact that after the successful revolution in Tunisia, it was the most peaceful transition in any North African or Middle Eastern country. And for 2 years, in October 2011, an Ennahda party won the elections and established a government with the help of its coalition partners. So they were running affairs smoothly. And what happened, something interesting happened here, that during this time, especially IMF's influence in the country was reduced. You know, all these countries, their economies, we also know in Egypt, and we also know in especially Tunisia, IMF and World Banks, they are running the country's economies. So these people somehow reduced their influence in the country. So what happened? This important leftist politician was killed out of the blue.
Right.
This looks a planning to bring technocrats government in the country. Technocrats government means unrepresentative government. Not a government, not the government of the politicians which are elected by the people. There is a push, international push, for a technocrat government in the country. The politicians might be there, but their role would be reduced. And technocrats who are not elected by the people, they are watching international monetary, international monetary funds.
And the World Bank as well, they actually said they were running the country.
Yeah, yeah, and they are watching their interest in the country, so they want a government of these people. So this looks the agenda in Tunisia.
But probably they need the World Bank and the IMF, don't they? Egypt is also asking for money.
Yeah, but they need, but the countries should not be run by their policies. They can provide money, but they cannot dictate countries' economies.
Okay.
When they dictate their terms, at the end we have seen that these international monetary institutions have destroyed the economies of the many countries,
right,
especially in the third world.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Gholjam Al-Sussein. Dr. Karimi, talking about Tunisia, I think to be honest with you, it seems it's quite strange, isn't it? I mean, first the Prime Minister says that we basically want to, dissolve the cabinet, and later on the Nasa parliamentary leader says no, it was unorganized. How come that? I mean, both of them belong to the same probably, sort of roots, but it's not organized. Was it not really organized? I mean, how far is this possibility?
Yes, I think that this is somehow an agreement between several parties there, or and also with the foreigners, because if the vote of people is important, then the parliament should decide.
Right.
And so if the ruling party, as we have it in the West, so when the ruling party has won the elections, then the ruling party also has a role and has in fact the highest voice there. But now the Islamist party and An-Nahda is the ruling party in Tunisia.
Right.
But other parties which are minorities are calling for changes. You know, this means that there is probably a plot, a kind of conspiracy. And we should analyze. We should, in fact, we should wait,
right,
to see what happens.
Mm.
As you said, this is somehow surprising, how in this kind of government, and so especially after the relative success of Tunisia in for the Islamist trend and also for the democracy and elections, why these things are happening.
Thanks very much indeed. Unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for the moment. But before I go, I'd like to thank again my top guests. We had Mr. Gholjam Al-Sussein, established journalist and top writer working with Tehran Times over the phone from Tehran. And we had Dr. Mahmoud Karimi, head of the Office for Academic and International Relations at Imam Sadiq University, in the studio. As always, your insights are much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming on, for talking to us, and of course, for those insights. Now, I'd also like to thank you, our dearest viewer, for having taken the time to watch this week's Central Stage. Until next week, from me, our guest today, and the rest of the team, it's goodbye for now. Thanks very much indeed for watching. Thank you very much. Great to have you with us. Thank you.